neither Baldwin nor Abdon Arias, but the worthy gentleman, Señor Quijada.
"I know who I am," replied Don Quixote, "and I know that I may be not only those I have named, but all the 12 peers of France, and even all the 9 worthies, since my achievements surpass all that they have done altogether and each of them on his own account."
With this talk, and more of the same kind, they reached the village just as night was beginning to fall. But the peasant waited until it was a little later, that the belaboured gentleman might not be seen riding in such a miserable trim. When it was what seemed to him the proper time, he entered the village and went to Don Quixote's house, which he found all in confusion, and there were the curate and the village barber, who were great friends of Don Quixote, and his housekeeper was saying to them in a loud voice,
"What does your worship think can have befallen my master, Dr. Pero Perez?"
For so the curate was called.
"It is 3 days now since anything has been seen of him, or the hack, or the shield, lance, or armour. Miserable me, I am certain of it, and it is as true as that I was born to die that these accursed books of chivalry he has, and has got into the way of reading so constantly, have upset his reason. For now I remember having often heard him saying to himself that he would turn knight-errant and go all over the world in quest of adventures. To the devil and Barabbas with such books that have brought to ruin in this way the finest understanding there was in all La Mancha."
The niece said the same and more.
"You must know, Master Nicholas," for that was the name of the barber, "it was often my uncle's way to stay 2 days and nights together poring over these unholy books of misventures, after which he would fling the book away and snatch up his sword and fall to slashing the walls. And when he was tired out, he would say he had killed 4 giants like 4 towers, and the sweat that flowed from him when he was weary, he said, was the blood of the wounds he had received in battle. And then he would drink a great jug of cold water, and become calm and quiet, saying that this water was a most precious potion which the sage Esquife, a great magician and friend of his, had brought him. But I take all the blame upon myself for never having told your worships of my uncle's vagaries, that you might put a stop to them before things had come to this pass, and burn all these accursed books, for he has a great number that richly deserve to be burned like heretics."
"So say I too," said the curate, "and by my faith tomorrow shall not pass without public judgment upon them, and may they be condemned to the flames, lest they lead those that read to behave as my good friend seems to have behaved."
All this the peasant heard, and from it he understood at last what was the matter with his neighbour. So he began calling aloud,
"Open, your worships, to Señor Baldwin, and to Señor the Marquis of Mantua, who comes badly wounded, and to Señor Abin Arias, the Moor, whom the valiant Rodrigo de Narvaez, the governor of Antequera, brings captive."
At these words they all hurried out, and when they recognized their friend, master, and uncle, who had not yet dismounted from the ass because he could not, they ran to embrace him.
"Hold," said he, "for I am badly wounded, through my horse's fault. Carry me to bed, and if possible send for the wise Urganda to cure and see to my wounds."
"See there, plague on it!" cried the housekeeper at this. "Did not my heart tell the truth as to which foot my master went lame of? To bed with your worship at once, and we will contrive to cure you here without fetching that Urganda. A curse, I say, once more, and 100 times more on those books of chivalry that have brought your worship to such a pass."
They carried him to bed at once, and after searching for his wounds could find none, but he said they were all bruises from having had a severe fall with his horse Rocinante when in combat with 10 giants, the biggest and the boldest to be found on earth.
So, said the curate, "are there giants in the dance? By the sign of the cross I will burn them tomorrow before the day is over."
They put a host of questions to Don Quixote, but his only answer to all was, "Give him something to eat, and leave him to sleep, for that was what he needed most." They did so, and the curate questioned the peasant at great length as to how he had found Don Quixote. He told him, and the nonsense he had talked when found and on the way home, all which made the curate the more eager to do what he did the next day, which was to summon his friend the barber, Master Nicholas, and go with him to Don Quixote's house. Chapter 6 Of the Diverting and Important Scrutiny Which the Curate and the Barber Made in the Library of Our Ingenious Gentleman. He was still sleeping, so the curate asked the niece for the keys of the room where the books, the authors of all the mischief, were, and right willingly she gave them. They all went in, the housekeeper with them, and found more than 100 volumes of big books, very well bound, and some other small ones. The moment the housekeeper saw them, she turned about and ran out of the room, and came back immediately with a saucer of holy water and a sprinkler, saying, "Here, your worships, sprinkle every part of the room, in case there is a magician of the many there are in these books, to bewitch us in revenge for our design of banishing them from the world." The simplicity of the housekeeper made the curate laugh, and he directed the barber to give him the books, one by one, to see what they were about, as there might be some to be found among them that did not deserve the penalty of fire.
"No," said the niece, "there is no reason for showing mercy to any of them. They have every one of them done mischief. Better fling them out of the window into the court and make a pile of them and set fire to them, or else carry them into the yard, and there a bonfire can be made without the smoke giving any annoyance."
The housekeeper said the same, so eager were they both for the slaughter of those innocents. But the curate would not agree to it without first reading, at any rate, the titles. The first that Master Nicholas put into his hand was The Four Books of Amadis of Gaul.
"This seems a mysterious thing," said the curate, "for, as I have heard say, this was the first book of chivalry printed in Spain, and from this all the others derive their birth and origin. So it seems to me that we ought inexorably to condemn it to the flames as the founder of so vile a sect."
"Nay, sir," said the barber, "I, too, have heard say that this is the best of all the books of this kind that have been written, and so, as something singular in its line, it ought to be pardoned."
"True," said the curate, "and for that reason let its life be spared for the present. Let us see that other which is next to it."
"It is," said the barber, "the Selgas de Esplandian, the lawful son of Amadis of Gaul."
"Then, verily," said the curate, "the merit of the father must not be put down to the account of the son. Take it, mistress housekeeper, open the window and fling it into the yard, and lay the foundation of the pile for the bonfire we are to make."
The housekeeper obeyed with great satisfaction, and the worthy Esplandian went flying into the yard to await with all patience the fire that was in store for him.
"Proceed," said the curate.
"This that comes next," says the barber, "is Amadis of Greece, and indeed I believe all those on this side are of the same Amadis lineage."
"Then to the yard with the whole of them," said the curate, "for to have the pleasure of burning Queen Pintikiniestra, and the shepherd Daranel and his eclogues, and the incomprehensibly convoluted discourses of his author, I would burn my own father if he were going about in the guise of a knight-errant."
"I am of the same mind," said the barber.
"And so am I," added the niece.
"In that case," said the housekeeper, "here, into the yard with them."
They were handed to her, and as there were many of them, she spared herself the staircase and flung them down out of the window.
"Who's in that tub there?" said the curate.
"This," said the barber, "is Don Olivante de Laura."
"The author of that book," said the curate, "was the same that wrote The Garden of Flowers, and truly there is no deciding which of the two books is the more truthful, or, to put it better, the less lying. All I can say is send this one into the yard for a swaggering fool."
"This that follows is Florismarte of Hircania," said the barber.
"Señor Florismarte here," said the curate. "Then, by my faith, he must take up his quarters in the yard, in spite of his marvellous birth and visionary adventures, for the stiffness and dryness of his style deserve nothing else. Into the yard with him and the other, mistress housekeeper."
"With all my heart, señor," said she,
and executed the order with great delight.
"This," said the barber, "is the Knight Platier." "An old book, that," said the curate. "But I find no reason for clemency in it. Send it after the others without appeal."
Which was done. Another book was opened, and they saw it was entitled The Knight of the Cross.
"For the sake of the holy name this book has," said the curate, "its ignorance might be excused. But then, they say, behind the cross there's the devil, so to the fire with it."
Taking down another book, the barber said,
"This is The Mirror of Chivalry,
"I know his worship," said the curate. "That is where Señor Reynaldos of Montalvan figures with his friends and comrades, greater thieves than Cacus, and the 12 peers of France with the trusty historian Turpine. However, I am for condemning them to perpetual banishment, because, at any rate, they have some share in the invention of the famous Matteo Boiardo, whence, too, the Christian poet Ludovico Ariosto wove his web. And if I find him here, speaking any language but his own, I shall show no respect whatever. But if he speaks in his own tongue, I will treat him with all deference."
"Well, I have a copy in Italian," said the barber, "but I do not understand him."
"Nor would it be well that you should understand him," said the curate. "And on that score we might have excused the captain if he had not brought him into Spain and turned him into Castilian. He robbed him of a great deal of his natural force, and so do all those who try to turn books written in verse into another language. For, with all the pains they take and all the cleverness they show, they never can reach the level of the originals as they were first produced. In short, I say that this book, and all that may be found treating of those French affairs, should be thrown into some dry well, until, after more consideration, it is settled what is to be done with them. Excepting always one, Bernardo del Carpio, that is going about, and another called Roncesvalles, for these, if they come into my hands, shall pass at once into those of the housekeeper, and from hers into the fire without any reprieve." To all this the barber gave his assent, and looked upon it as right and proper, being persuaded that the curate was so staunch to the faith and loyal to the truth that he would not for the world say anything opposed to them. Opening another book, he saw it was Palmarine de Oliva, and beside it was another called Palmarine of England, seeing which the curate said, "Aha! Let the olive be made firewood of at once and burned until no ashes even are left, but let that palm of England be kept and preserved as something unique, and let such a case be made for it as that which Alexander found among the spoils of Darius and set aside for the safekeeping of the works of the poet Homer. This book, my friend, is of authority for two reasons. First, because it is very good, and secondly, because it is said to have been written by a wise and witty king of Portugal. All the adventures of the castle of Miraguarda are excellent and of admirable contrivance, and the language is polished and clear, studying and observing the style befitting the speaker with propriety and judgment. So then, provided it seems good to you, Master Nicholas, I say let this and Amadis of Gaul be remitted the penalty of fire, and as for all the rest, let them perish without further question or query."
"Nay, neighbour," said the barber, "for this that I have here is the famous Don Belianis."
"Well," said the curate, "that and the second, third, and fourth parts all stand in need of a little rhubarb to purge their excess of bile, and they must be cleared of all that stuff about the Castle of Fame and other greater affectations. To which end, let them be allowed a reprieve till they prepare a defence, and according as they mend, so shall mercy or justice be meted out to them. And in the meantime, my friend, do you keep them in your house, and let no one read them."
"With all my heart," said the barber.
And not caring to tire himself with reading more books of chivalry, he told the housekeeper to take all the big ones and throw them into the yard. It was not said to one dull or deaf, but to one who enjoyed burning them more than weaving the broadest and finest web that could be. And seizing about 8 at a time, she flung them out of the window. In carrying so many together, she let one fall at the feet of the barber, who took it up, curious to know whose it was, and found it said, "History of the famous knight Tirante el Blanco."
"God bless me!" said the curate with a shout. "Tirante el Blanco, here, hand it over, my friend, for in it I reckon I have found a treasury of enjoyment and a mine of recreation. Here is Don Kyrieleison of Montalvan, a valiant knight, and his brother Thomas of Montalvan, and the knight Fonseca, with the battle the bold Tirante fought with the mastiff, and the witticisms of the damsel Placer de Mivida, and the loves and wiles of the widow Reposada, and the empress in love with the squire Ippolito. In truth, my friend, by right of its style, it is the best book in the world. Here knights eat and sleep and die in their beds, and make their wills before dying, and a great deal more of which there is nothing in all the other books. Nevertheless,
I say he who wrote it, for deliberately composing such fooleries, deserves to be sent to the galleys for life. Take it home with you and read it, and you'll see what I've said is true.
As you will, said the barber. But what are we to do with these little books that are left?
These must be not chivalry, but poetry, said the curate. And opening one, he saw it was the Diana of Jorge de Montemayor, and supposing all the others to be of the same sort, these, he said, do not deserve to be burned like the others, for they neither do nor can do the mischief the books of chivalry have done, being books of entertainment that can hurt no one.
Ah, senor, said the niece, your worship had better order these to be burned as well as the others, for it would be no wonder if, after being cured of his chivalry disorder, my uncle, by reading these, took a fancy to turn shepherd and range the woods and fields singing and piping, or, what would be still worse, to turn poet, which they say is an incurable and infectious malady.
The damsel is right, said the curate, and it will be well to put this stumbling block and temptation out of our friend's way. To begin, then, with the Diana of Montemayor. I am of the opinion it should not be burned, but that it should be cleared of all that about the sage Felicia and the magic water, and of almost all the longer pieces of verse. Let it keep and welcome its prose, and the honour of being the first of books of the kind.
This that comes next, said the barber, is the Diana, entitled a second part, by the Salamancan, and this other has the same title, and its author is Gil Polo.
As for that of the Salamancan, replied the curate, let it go to swell the number of the condemned in the yard. But let Gil Polo's be preserved, as if it came from Apollo himself. But get on, friend, and make haste, for it is growing late.
This book, said the barber, opening another, is the 10 books of the Fortune of Love, written by Antonio de Lofraso, a Sardinian poet.
By the orders I have received, said the curate, since Apollo has been Apollo, and the muses have been musets, and poets have been poets, so droll and absurd a book as this has never been written, and in its way it is the best and the most singular of all this species that have as yet appeared, and he who has not read it may be sure he has never read what is delightful. Give it here, my friend, for I make more account of having found this than if they had given me a cassock of Florence stuff.
He put it aside with extreme satisfaction, and the barber went on,
These that come next are the Shepherd of Iberia, Nymphs of Henares, and the Cure of Jealousy.
Then all we have to do, said the curate, is to hand them over to the secular arm of the housekeeper, and ask me not why, or we shall never have done.
This next is the Pastor de Filida.
No pastor that, said the curate, but a highly polished courtier. Let it be preserved as a precious jewel.
This large one here, said the barber, is called the Treasury of Various Poems.
If there were not so many of them, said the curate, they would be more relished. This book must be weeded and cleansed of certain vulgarities which it has with its excellences. Let it be preserved, because the author is a friend of mine, and out of respect for other more heroic and loftier works that he has written.
This, continued the barber, is the Cancionero of Lopez de Maldonado.
The author of that book, too, said the curate, is a great friend of mine, and his verses, from his own mouth, are the admiration of all who hear them, for such is the sweetness of his voice that he enchants when he chants them. It gives rather too much of its eclogues, but what is good is ever plentiful. Let it be kept with those that have been set apart.
But what book is that next it? "The Galatea of Miguel de Cervantes," said the barber.
"That Cervantes has been for many years a great friend of mine, and, to my knowledge, he has had more experience in reverses than in verses. His book has some good invention in it. It presents us with something, but brings nothing to a conclusion. We must wait for the second part, it promises. Perhaps, with amendment, it may succeed in winning the full measure of grace that is now denied it. And in the meantime do you, my very good man, keep it shut up in your own quarters."
"Very good," said the barber. "And here come 3 together. The Araucana of Don Alonso de Ercilia, the Astriada of Juan Rufo, Justice of Cordova, and the Monserrate of Cristobal de Virues, the Valencian poet."
"These 3 books,"
said the curate, "are the best that have been written in Castilian in heroic verse, and they may compare with the most famous of Italy. Let them be preserved as the richest treasures of poetry that Spain possesses." The curate was tired and would not look into any more books, and so he decided that, contents uncertified, all the rest should be burned. But just then the barber held open one called The Tears of Angelica. "I should have shed tears myself," said the curate, when he heard the title, "had I ordered that book to be burned, for its author was one of the most famous poets, not just of Spain, but of the world, and was very happy translating some of Ovid's fables." Chapter 7 Of the Second Sally of Our Worthy Knight, Don Quixote of La Mancha. At this instant Don Quixote began shouting out,
"Here, here, valiant knights, here is need for you to put forth the might of your strong arms, for they of the court are gaining the mastery in the tourney."
Called away by this noise and outcry, they proceeded no farther with the scrutiny of the remaining books. And so it is thought that the Carolea, the Lion of Spain, and the Deeds of the Emperor, written by Don Luis de Avila, went to the fire unseen and unheard. For no doubt they were among those that remained, and perhaps, if the curate had seen them, they would not have undergone so severe a sentence. When they reached Don Quixote, he was already out of bed, and was still shouting and raving and slashing and cutting all round, as wide awake as if he had never slept. They closed with him, and by force got him back to bed, and when he had become a little calm, addressing the curate, he said to him,
"Of a truth, Señor Archbishop Turpin, it is a great disgrace for us who call ourselves the 12 peers so carelessly to allow the knights of the court to gain the victory in this tourney, we the adventurers having carried off the honour on the 3 former days."
"Hush, my friend," said the curate. "Please God, the luck may turn, and what is lost today may be won tomorrow. For the present, let your worship have a care of your health, for it seems to me that you are over-fatigued, if not badly wounded."
"Wounded... no," said Don Quixote, "but bruised and battered, no doubt, for that bastard Don Roland has cudgelled me with the trunk of an oak tree, and all for envy, because he sees that I alone rival him in his achievements. But call me not Reinaldos of Montalban if he does not pay me for it in spite of all his enchantments as soon as I rise from this bed. For the present, let them bring me something to eat, for that, I feel, is what will be more to my purpose. And leave it to me to avenge myself."
They did as he wished. They gave him something to eat, and once more he fell asleep, leaving them marvelling at his madness. That night the housekeeper burned to ashes all the books that were in the yard and in the whole house, and some must have been consumed that deserved preservation in everlasting archives, but their fate and the laziness of the examiner did not permit it. And so in them was verified the proverb that the innocent suffer for the guilty. One of the remedies which the curate and the barber immediately applied to their friend's disorder was to wall up and plaster the room where the books were, so that when he got up he should not find them, possibly the cause being removed the effect might cease, and they might say that a magician had carried them off, room and all. And this was done with all dispatch. 2 days later Don Quixote got up, and the first thing he did was to go and look at his books, and not finding the room where he had left it, he wandered from side to side looking for it. He came to the place where the door used to be and tried it with his hands, and turned and twisted his eyes in every direction without saying a word. But after a good while he asked his housekeeper whereabouts was the room that held his books. The housekeeper, who had been already well instructed in what she was to answer, said,
"What room or what nothing is it that your worship is looking for? There are neither room nor books in this house now, for the devil himself has carried all away."
"It was not the devil," said the niece, "but a magician who came on a cloud one night, after the day your worship left this, and dismounting from a serpent that he rode, he entered the room, and what he did there I know not, but after a little while he made off, flying through the roof, and left the house full of smoke. And when we went to see what he had done, we saw neither book nor room. But we remember very well, the housekeeper and I, that on leaving, the old villain said in a loud voice that, for a private grudge he owed the owner of the books and the room, he had done mischief in that house that would be discovered by and by. He said, too, that his name was the sage Munaton.
"He must have said Friston," said Don Quixote.
"I don't know whether he called himself Friston or Friton," said the housekeeper. "I only know that his name ended with Ton."
"So it does," said Don Quixote. "And he is a sage magician, a great enemy of mine, who has a spite against me because he knows by his arts and lore that in process of time I am to engage in single combat with a knight whom he befriends, and that I am to conquer, and he will be unable to prevent it. And for this reason he endeavours to do me all the ill turns that he can. But I promise him it will be hard for him to oppose or avoid what is decreed by heaven."
"Who doubts that?" said the niece. "But, uncle, who mixes you up in these quarrels? Would it not be better to remain at peace in your own house instead of roaming the world looking for better bread than ever came of wheat, never reflecting that many go for wool and come back shorn?"
"Oh, niece of mine," replied Don Quixote, "how much astray art thou in thy reckoning! Ere they shear me, I shall have plucked away and stripped off the beards of all who dare to touch only the tip of a hair of mine."
The two were unwilling to make any further answer, as they saw that his anger was kindling. In short, then, he remained at home 15 days very quietly, without showing any signs of a desire to take up with his former delusions, and during this time he held lively discussions with his two friends, the curate and the barber, on the point he maintained that knights errant were what the world stood most in need of, and that in him was to be accomplished the revival of knight errantry. The curate sometimes contradicted him, sometimes agreed with him, for if he had not observed this precaution he would have been unable to bring him to reason. Meanwhile, Don Quixote worked upon a farm labourer, a neighbour of his, an honest man, if indeed that title can be given to him who is poor, but with very little wit in his pate. In a word, he so talked him over, and with such persuasions and promises, that the poor clown made up his mind to sally forth with him, and serve as his squire. Don Quixote, among other things, told him he ought to be ready to go with him gladly, because any moment an adventure might occur that might win an island in the twinkling of an eye, and leave him governor of it. On these and the like promises, Sancho Panza, for so the labourer was called, left wife and children, and engaged himself as squire to his neighbour. Don Quixote next set about getting some money, and selling one thing and pawning another, and making a bad bargain in every case, he got together a fair sum. He provided himself with a shield, which he begged as a loan from a friend, and, restoring his battered helmet as best he could, he warned his squire Sancho of the day and hour he meant to set out, that he might provide himself with what he thought most needful. Above all, he charged him to take saddlebags with him. The other said he would, and that he meant to take also a very good ass he had, as he was not much given to going on foot. About the ass, Don Quixote hesitated a little, trying whether he could call to mind any knight-errant taking with him a squire mounted on ass-back, but no instance occurred to his memory. For all that, however, he determined to take him, intending to furnish him with a more honourable mount when a chance of it presented itself, by appropriating the horse of the first discourteous knight he encountered. Himself he provided with shirts and such other things as he could, according to the advice the host had given him. All which being done without taking leave, Sancho Panza of his wife and children, or Don Quixote of his housekeeper and niece, they sallied forth unseen by anybody from the village one night, and made such good way in the course of it that by daylight they held themselves safe from discovery, even should search be made for them. Sancho rode on his ass like a patriarch, with his saddlebags and bottle, and longing to see himself soon governor of the island his master had promised him. Don Quixote decided upon taking the same route and road he had taken on his first journey, that over the Campo de Montiel, which he travelled with less discomfort than on the last occasion, for, as it was early morning and the rays of the sun fell on them obliquely, the heat could not distress them. "And now," said Sancho Panza to his master,
"Your worship will take care, Senor Knight-errant,
not to forget about the island you have promised me, for be it ever so big, I'll be equal to governing it."
To which Don Quixote replied, "Thou must know, friend Sancho Panza, that it was a practice very much in vogue with the knights errant of old, to make their squires governors of the islands or kingdoms they won, and I am determined there shall be no failure on my part in so liberal a custom. On the contrary, I mean to improve upon it, for they sometimes, and perhaps most frequently, waited until their squires were old, and then, when they had had enough of service and hard days and worse nights, they gave them some title or other of count, or at the most marquis, of some valley or province, more or less. But if thou livest, and I live, it may well be that before 6 days are over I may have won some kingdom that has others dependent upon it, which will be just the thing to enable thee to be crowned king of one of them. Nor needst thou count this wonderful, for things and chances fall to the lot of such knights in ways so unexampled and unexpected that I might easily give thee even more than I promise thee."
"In that case," said Sancho Panza, "if I should become a king by one of those miracles your worship speaks of, even Juana Gutierrez, my old woman, would come to be queen and my children princes."
"Well, who doubts it?" said Don Quixote.
"I doubt it," replied Sancho Panza, "because, for my part, I am persuaded that though God should shower down kingdoms upon earth, not one of them would sit well on the head of Mari Gutierrez. Let me tell you, senor, she's not worth 2 brass farthings as a queen. Countess might fit her better, though that only with God's help."
"Leave it to God, Sancho," returned Don Quixote, "for he will give her what suits her best. But do not undervalue thyself so much as to come to be content with anything less than being governor of a province."
"I will not, senor," answered Sancho, "especially as I have a man of such quality for a master in your worship, who will know how to give me all that will be suitable for me and that I can bear."
Chapter 8 Of the Good Fortune Which the Valiant Don Quixote Had in the Terrible and Undreamt-of Adventure of the Windmills, with Other Occurrences Worthy to be Fitly Recorded. At this point they came in sight of 30 or 40 windmills that there are on that plain, and as soon as Don Quixote saw them, he said to his squire,
"Fortune is arranging matters for us better than we could have shaped our desires ourselves, for look there, friend Sancho Panza, where 30 or more monstrous giants present themselves, all of whom I mean to engage in battle and slay, and with whose spoils we shall begin to make our fortunes. For this is righteous warfare, and it is God's good service to sweep so evil a breed from off the face of the earth."
"What giants?" said Sancho Panza.
"Those thou seest there," answered his master, "with the long arms, and some have them nearly 2 leagues long."
"Look, your worship," said Sancho, "what we see there are not giants, but windmills, and what seem to be their arms are the sails that, turned by the wind, make the millstone go."
"It is easy to see," replied Don Quixote, "that thou art not used to this business of adventures. Those are giants. And if thou art afraid, away with thee out of this, and betake thyself to prayer while I engage them in fierce and unequal combat."
So saying, he gave the spur to his steed Rocinante, heedless of the cries his squire Sancho sent after him, warning him that most certainly they were windmills and not giants he was going to attack. He, however, was so positive they were giants that he neither heard the cries of Sancho, nor perceived, near as he was, what they were, but made at them, shouting,
"Fly not, cowards and vile beings, for a single knight attacks you."
A slight breeze at this moment sprang up, and the great sails began to move, seeing which Don Quixote exclaimed,
"Though ye flourish more arms than the giant Briareus, ye have to reckon with me."
So saying, and commending himself with all his heart to his lady Dulcinea, imploring her to support him in such a peril, with lance in rest and covered by his shield, he charged at Rocinante's fullest gallop and fell upon the first mill that stood in front of him. But as he drove his lance-point into the sail, the wind whirled it round with such force that it shivered the lance to pieces, sweeping horse and rider to the ground, who went rolling over on the plain in a sorry condition. Sancho hastened to his assistance as fast as his ass could go, and when he came up found him unable to move. With such a shock had Rocinante fallen with him.
"God bless me," said Sancho. "Did I not tell your worship to mind what you were about, for they were only windmills? And no one could have made any mistake about it but one who had something of the same kind in his head."
"Hush, friend Sancho," replied Don Quixote. "The fortunes of war, more than any other, are liable to frequent fluctuations. And moreover, I think, and it is the truth, that that same sage Friston, who carried off my study and books, has turned these giants into mills in order to rob me of the glory of vanquishing them. Such is the enmity he bears me. But in the end, his wicked arts will avail but little against my good sword."
"God order it as he may," said Sancho Panza,
and helping him to rise, got him up again on Rocinante, whose shoulder was half out. And then, discussing the late adventure, they followed the road to the Lapice Pass, for there, said Don Quixote, they could not fail to find adventures in abundance and variety, as it was a great thoroughfare. For all that, he was much grieved at the loss of his lance, and saying so to his squire, he added,
"I remember having read how a Spanish knight, Diego Perez de Vargas by name, having broken his sword in battle, tore from an oak a ponderous bough or branch, and with it did such things that day, and pounded so many Moors, that he got the surname of Machuca, and he and his descendants from that day forth were called Vargas y Machuca. I mention this because from the first oak I see, I mean to rend such another branch, large and stout like that, with which I am determined and resolved to do such deeds that thou mayest deem thyself very fortunate in being found worthy to come and see them, and be an eyewitness of things that will with difficulty be believed."
"Be that as God will," said Sancho. "I believe it all as your worship says it. Straighten yourself a little, for you seem all on one side, maybe from the shaking of the fall."
"That is the truth," said Don Quixote, "and if I make no complaint of the pain, it is because knights-errant are not permitted to complain of any wound, even though their bowels be coming out through it."
"If so," said Sancho, "I have nothing to say. But God knows I would rather your worship complained when anything ailed you. For my part, I confess I must complain, however small the ache may be, unless this rule about not complaining extends to the squires of knights-errant also."
Don Quixote could not help laughing at his squire's simplicity, and he assured him he might complain whenever and however he chose, just as he liked, for, so far, he had never read of anything to the contrary in the order of knighthood. Sancho bade him remember it was dinner-time, to which his master answered that he wanted nothing himself just then, but that he might eat when he had a mind. With this permission, Sancho settled himself as comfortably as he could on his beast, and taking out of the saddle-bags what he had stowed away in them, he jogged along behind his master, munching deliberately, and from time to time taking a pull at the bottle with a relish that the thirstiest tapster in Malaga might have envied. And while he went on in this way, gulping down draught after draught, he never gave a thought to any of the promises his master had made him, nor did he rate going in quest of adventures as hardship, but rather as recreation, however dangerous they might be. Finally they passed the night among some trees, from one of which Don Quixote plucked a dry branch to serve him after a fashion as a lance, and fixed it on the head he had removed from the broken one. All that night Don Quixote lay awake thinking of his lady Dulcinea, in order to conform to what he had read in his books, how many a night in the forests and deserts knights used to lie sleepless, supported by the memory of their mistresses. Not so did Sancho Panza spend it, for having his stomach full of something stronger than chicory water, he made but one sleep of it, and if his master had not called him, neither the rays of the sun beating on his face, nor all the cheery notes of the birds welcoming the approach of day would have had the power to waken him. On getting up, he tried the bottle, and found it somewhat less full than the night before, which grieved his heart, because they did not seem to be on the way to remedy the deficiency readily. Don Quixote did not care to break his fast, for, as has been already said, he confined himself to savoury recollections for nourishment. They returned to the road they had set out with, leading to the Lapice Pass, and at 3 in the afternoon they came in sight of it.
"Here, brother Sancho Panza," said Don Quixote when he saw it,
we may plunge our hands up to the elbows in what they call adventures. But observe, even shouldst thou see me in the greatest danger in the world, thou must not put a hand to thy sword in my defence, unless, indeed, thou perceivest that those who assail me are rabble or base folk. For in that case thou mayest very properly aid me, but if they be knights, it is on no account permitted or allowed thee by the laws of knighthood to help me until thou hast been dubbed a knight.
"Most certainly, senor," replied Sancho, "your worship shall be fully obeyed in this matter, all the more as of myself I am peaceful and no friend to mixing in strife and quarrels. It is true that as regards the defence of my own person, I shall not give much heed to those laws, for laws human and divine allow each one to defend himself against any assailant whatever."
"That I grant," said Don Quixote, "but in this matter of aiding me against knights, thou must put a restraint upon thy natural impetuosity."
"I will do so, I promise you," answered Sancho, "and will keep this precept as carefully as Sunday."
While they were thus talking, there appeared on the road two friars of the Order of St. Benedict, mounted on what seemed to be two dromedaries, for not less tall were the two mules they rode on. They wore travelling masks and carried sunshades, and behind them came a coach attended by four or five persons on horseback, and two muleteers on foot. In the coach there was, as afterwards appeared, a Biscay lady on her way to Seville, where her husband was about to take passage for the Indies with an appointment of high honour. The friars, though going the same road, were not in her company. But the moment Don Quixote perceived them, he said to his squire, "Either I am mistaken, or this is going to be the most famous adventure that has ever been seen. For those black bodies we see there must be, and doubtless are, magicians, who are carrying off some stolen princess in that coach, and with all my might I must undo this wrong."
"This will be worse than the windmills," said Sancho. "Look, senor, those are friars of St. Benedict, and the coach plainly belongs to some travellers. I tell you to mind well what you are about, and don't let the devil mislead you."
"I have told thee already, Sancho," replied Don Quixote, "that on the subject of adventures thou knowest little. What I say is the truth, as thou shalt see presently." So saying, he advanced and posted himself in the middle of the road along which the friars were coming, and as soon as he thought they had come near enough to hear what he said, he cried aloud, "Devilish and unnatural beings, release instantly the high-born princesses whom you are carrying off by force in this coach, else prepare to meet a speedy death as the just punishment of your evil deeds." The friars drew rein and stood wondering at the appearance of Don Quixote, as well as at his words, to which they replied,
"Señor Caballero, we are not devilish or unnatural, but two brothers of St. Benedict, following our road, nor do we know whether or not there are any captive princesses coming in this coach."
"No soft words with me, for I know you, lying rabble," said Don Quixote, and without waiting for a reply he spurred Rocinante and with levelled lance charged the first friar with such fury and determination that if the friar had not flung himself off the mule he would have brought him to the ground against his will and sore wounded, if not killed outright. The second brother, seeing how his comrade was treated, drove his heels into his fleshy mule and made off across the country faster than the wind.
Sancho Panza, when he saw the friar on the ground, dismounting briskly from his ass, rushed towards him and began to strip off his gown. At that instant the friar's muleteers came up and asked him what he was stripping him for. Sancho answered them that this fell to him lawfully as spoil of the battle which his lord Don Quixote had won. The muleteers, who had no idea of a joke and did not understand all this about battles and spoils, seeing that Don Quixote was some distance off talking to the travellers in the coach, fell upon Sancho, knocked him down, and leaving hardly a hair in his beard, belaboured him with kicks, and left him stretched breathless and senseless on the ground, and without any more delay helped the friar to mount, who, trembling, terrified and pale, as soon as he found himself in the saddle, spurred after his companion, who was standing at a distance, looking on, watching the result of the onslaught. Then, not caring to wait for the end of the affair just begun, they pursued their journey, making more crosses than if they had the devil after them. Don Quixote was, as has been said, speaking to the lady in the coach. "Your beauty, lady mine," said he, "may now dispose of your person as may be most in accordance with your pleasure, for the pride of your ravishers lies prostrate on the ground through this strong arm of mine. And lest you should be pining to know the name of your deliverer, know that I am called Don Quixote of La Mancha, a knight-errant and adventurer, and captive to the peerless and beautiful Lady Dulcinea del Toboso. And in return for the service you have received of me, I ask no more than that you should return to El Toboso, and on my behalf present yourself before that lady, and tell her what I have done to set you free." One of the squires in attendance upon the coach, a Biscayan, was listening to all Don Quixote was saying, and perceiving that he would not allow the coach to go on, but was saying it must return at once to El Toboso, he made at him, and seizing his lance, addressed him in bad Castilian and worse Biscayan, after this fashion:
"Begone, caballero, and ill go with thee. By the God that made me, unless you quit coach, I slay you, as I'm here a Biscayan."
Don Quixote understood him quite well, and answered him very quietly, "If thou wert a knight, as thou art none, I should have already chastised thy folly and rashness, miserable creature." To which the Biscayan returned,
"Ay, no, gentleman, I swear to God you lie, as I am a Christian. Drop lance and draw sword, you'll soon sear you carry water to the cat. Biscayan on land, gentleman at sea, gentleman by the devil, and look, if you say otherwise, you lying."
"You will see presently," said Agrayes, replied Don Quixote,
and throwing his lance on the ground, he drew his sword, braced his shield on his arm, and attacked the Biscayan, bent upon taking his life. The Biscayan, when he saw him coming on, though he wished to dismount from his mule, in which, being one of those sorry ones let out for hire, he had no confidence, had no choice but to draw his sword. It was lucky for him, however, that he was near the coach, from which he was able to snatch a cushion that served him for a shield, and they went at one another as if they had been two mortal enemies. The others strove to make peace between them, but could not, for the Biscayan declared in his disjointed phrases that if they did not let him finish his battle, he would kill his mistress and everyone that strove to prevent him. The lady in the coach, amazed and terrified at what she saw, ordered the coachman to draw aside a little, and set herself to watch this severe struggle, in the course of which the Biscayan smote Don Quixote a mighty stroke on the shoulder over the top of his shield, which, given to one without armour, would have cleft him to the waist. Don Quixote, feeling the weight of this prodigious blow, cried aloud, saying, "Oh, lady of my soul, Dulcinea, flower of beauty, come to the aid of this your knight, who, in fulfilling his obligations to your beauty, finds himself in this extreme peril." To say this, to lift his sword, to shelter himself well behind his shield, and to assail the Biscayan, was the work of an instant, determined as he was to venture all upon a single blow. The Biscayan, seeing him come on in this way, was convinced of his courage by his spirited bearing, and resolved to follow his example. So he waited for him, keeping well under cover of his cushion, being unable to execute any sort of manoeuvre with his mule, which, dead tired and never meant for this kind of game, could not stir a step. On, then, as aforesaid, came Don Quixote against the wary Biscayan, with uplifted sword and a firm intention of splitting him in half, while on his side the Biscayan waited for him sword in hand and under the protection of his cushion. And all present stood trembling, waiting in suspense the result of blows such as threatened to fall, and the lady in the coach and the rest of her following were making a thousand vows and offerings to all the images and shrines of Spain, that God might deliver her squire and all of them from this great peril in which they found themselves. But it spoils all that at this point and crisis, the author of the history leaves this battle impending, giving as excuse that he could find nothing more written about these achievements of Don Quixote than what has been already set forth. It is true the second author of this work was unwilling to believe that a history so curious could have been allowed to fall under the sentence of oblivion, or that the wits of La Mancha could have been so undiscerning as not to preserve in their archives or registries some documents referring to this famous knight. And this being his persuasion, he did not despair of finding the conclusion of this pleasant history, which, heaven favouring him, he did find, in a way that shall be related in the second part. Part 2 Chapter 9 In which is concluded the terrific battle between the gallant Biscayan and the valiant Manchegan. In the first part of this history, we left the valiant Biscayan and the renowned Don Quixote with drawn swords uplifted, ready to deliver two such furious slashing blows that if they had fallen full and fair, they would at least have split and cleft them asunder from top to toe and laid them open like a pomegranate. And at this so critical point, the delightful history came to a stop and stood cut short without any intimation from the author where what was missing was to be found. This distressed me greatly, because the pleasure derived from having read such a small portion turned to vexation at the thought of the poor chance that presented itself of finding the large part that, so it seems to me, was missing of such an interesting tale. It appeared to me to be a thing impossible and contrary to all precedent that so good a knight should have been without some sage to undertake the task of writing his marvellous achievements, a thing that was never wanting to any of those knights errant who, they say, went after adventures. For every one of them had one or two sages, as if made on purpose, who not only recorded their deeds, but described their most trifling thoughts and follies, however secret they might be. And such a good knight could not have been so unfortunate as not to have what Platir and others like him had in abundance. And so I could not bring myself to believe that such a gallant tale had been left maimed and mutilated, and I laid the blame on time, the devourer and destroyer of all things, that had either concealed or consumed it. On the other hand, it struck me that, inasmuch as among his books there had been found such modern ones as The Cure of Jealousy and The Nymphs and Shepherds of Henares, his story must likewise be modern, and that, though it might not be written, it might exist in the memory of the people of his village and of those in the neighbourhood. This reflection kept me perplexed and longing to know really and truly the whole life and wondrous deeds of our famous Spaniard, Don Quixote of La Mancha, light and mirror of Manchegan chivalry, and the first that in our age, and in these so evil days, devoted himself to the labour and exercise of the arms of knight-errantry, righting wrongs, succouring widows, and protecting damsels of that sort that used to ride about, whip in hand, on their palfreys, with all their virginity about them, from mountain to mountain and valley to valley. For if it were not for some ruffian or boar with a hood and hatchet, or monstrous giant that forced them, there were in days of yore damsels that at the end of 80 years, in all which time they had never slept a day under a roof, went to their graves as much maids as the mothers that bore them. I say, then, that in these and other respects our gallant Don Quixote is worthy of everlasting and notable praise. Nor should it be withheld even from me, for the labour and pains I spent in searching for the conclusion of this delightful history, though I know well that if heaven, chance, and good fortune had not helped me, the world would have remained deprived of an entertainment and pleasure that, for a couple of hours or so, may well occupy him who shall read it attentively. The discovery of it occurred in this way. One day, as I was in the Toledo Exchange, a boy came up to sell some books and old papers to a silk mercer, and as I am fond of reading even the very scraps of paper in the streets, led by this natural bent of mine, I took up one of the books the boy had for sale, and saw that it was in characters which I recognized as Arabic, and as I was unable to read them, though I could recognize them, I looked about to see if there were any Spanish-speaking Moor at hand to read them for me. Nor was there any great difficulty in finding such an interpreter, for even had I sought one for an older and better language, I should have found him. In short, chance provided me with one, who, when I told him what I wanted and put the book into his hands, opened it in the middle, and after reading a little in it, began to laugh. I asked him what he was laughing at, and he replied that it was at something the book had written in the margin by way of a note. I bade him tell it to me, and he, still laughing, said, "In the margin, as I told you, this is written." This Dulcinea del Toboso, so often mentioned in this history, had, they say, the best hand of any woman in all La Mancha for salting pork. When I heard Dulcinea del Toboso named, I was struck with surprise and amazement, for it occurred to me at once that these books contained the history of Don Quixote. With this idea, I pressed him to read the beginning, and doing so, turning the Arabic offhand into Castilian, he told me it meant, "History of Don Quixote of La Mancha, written by Cide Hamete Benengeli, an Arab historian." It required great caution to hide the joy I felt when the title of the book reached my ears, and snatching it from the silk mercer, I bought all the papers and books from the boy for half a real. And if he had had his wits about him and had known how eager I was for them, he might have safely calculated on making more than 6 reals by the bargain. I withdrew at once with the Moor into the cloister of the cathedral, and begged him to turn all these books that related to Don Quixote into the Castilian tongue, without omitting or adding anything to them, offering him whatever payment he pleased. He was satisfied with 60-odd pounds of raisins and 2 bushels of wheat, and promised to translate them faithfully and with all dispatch. But to make the matter easier, and not to let such a precious find out of my hands, I took him to my house, where, in little more than a month and a half, he translated the whole just as it is set down here. In the first book there was a picture of the battle between Don Quixote and the Biscayan, drawn to the very life, with the same attitude as the story describes, their swords raised, and the one protected by his shield, the other by his cushion, and the Biscayan's mule so true to nature that it could be seen to be a hired one a bow shot off. The Biscayan had an inscription under his feet which said, "Don Sancho de Azpeitia," which no doubt must have been his name, and at the feet of Rocinante was another that said, "Don Quixote." Rocinante was marvellously portrayed, so long and thin, so lank and lean, with so much backbone and so far gone in consumption, that he showed plainly with what judgment and propriety the name of Rocinante had been bestowed upon him. Near him was Sancho Panza, holding the halter of his ass, at whose feet was another label that said, "Sancho Zancas," and, according to the picture, he must have had a big belly, or panza, a short body, and long shanks, Zancas, for which reason, no doubt, the names of Panza and Zancas were given him, for by these 2 surnames the history several times calls him. Some other trifling particulars might be mentioned, but they are all of slight importance, and have nothing to do with the true relation of the history. And no history can be bad, so long as it is true. If, against the present one, any objection be raised on the score of its truth, it can only be that its author was an Arab, as lying is a very common propensity with those of that nation. Though, as they are such enemies of ours, it is conceivable that there were omissions rather than additions made in the course of it. And this is my own opinion, for where he could and should give freedom to his pen in praise of so worthy a knight, he seems to me deliberately to pass it over in silence, which is ill done and worse contrived, for it is the business and duty of historians to be exact, truthful, and wholly free from passion, and neither interest nor fear, hatred nor love should make them swerve from the path of truth, whose mother is history, rival of time, storehouse of deeds, witness for the past, example and counsel for the present, and warning for the future. In this history I know will be found all that can be desired in the pleasantest. And if it be wanting in any good quality, I maintain it is the fault of its hound of an author, and not the fault of the subject. To be brief, its second part, according to the translation, began this way. With trenchant swords upraised and poised on high, it seemed as though the 2 valiant and wrathful combatants stood threatening heaven, and earth, and hell, with such resolution and determination did they bear themselves. The fiery Biscayan was the first to strike a blow, which was delivered with such force and fury that had not the sword turned in its course, that single stroke would have sufficed to put an end to the bitter struggle and to all the adventures of our knight. But that good fortune which reserved him for greater things turned aside the sword of his adversary, so that although it smote him upon the left shoulder, it did him no more harm than to strip all that side of its armour, carrying away a great part of his helmet with half of his ear, all which with fearful ruin fell to the ground, leaving him in a sorry plight. Good God! Who is there that could properly describe the rage that filled the heart of our Manchegan when he saw himself dealt with in this fashion? All that can be said is, it was such that he again raised himself in his stirrups, and, grasping his sword more firmly with both hands, he came down on the Biscayan with such fury, smiting him full over the cushion and over the head, that, even so good a shield proving useless, as if a mountain had fallen on him, he began to bleed from nose, mouth, and ears, reeling as if about to fall backwards from his mule,